Good morning, colleagues. I'm going to call to order this Wednesday, March 13, 2013 meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Welcome. We have a couple of interesting bills that we're going to get have public hearings on. Then we have a work session on a bill that is coming to us from the Senate, a public hearing and a work session. And then we will have an informational hearing on the cost drivers of higher education from Vice Chancellor Jay Kenton. So I am going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3015. And Victoria, could you tell us what that is?
Happy to, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3015 requires the State Board of Higher Education to adopt rules prohibiting universities from providing student information to persons engaged in the business of soliciting credit cards without express written consent of students and prohibiting advertising credit card offers in official university publications, including online publications.
Okay, thank you. So I am going to call up Representative Borsuk. Would you go down?
Sure.
And Representative Barton and Emma Calloway. Is Emma here?
No.
Not yet.
Okay. So you told the students at
right.
8 a.m.
tonight for the
All right,
kids.
Brent, you're going to have to be our stand-in student. If you would. Oh, Rep. Gallegos as well. Okay, great. Excellent.
Does the guy on the right?
Absolutely.
Does he know it's higher education?
Yeah. He had a birthday the other day,
Julian.
That's okay. And so I believe so.
All right, if you say so.
It's got to
answer. Okay, who wants to start?
No, I want to go first.
Okay, apparently I'm going to go first. All right, three reps in a row.
Yeah.
Great, thank you.
All right. Good morning, Chair, members of the community. I was going to say community. That wouldn't have been
mm-hmm.
right. My name is Chris Gorsuch. I'm the representative from District 49, which is Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and a little bit of Portland. I'm here to speak to you today on House Bill 3025. So I'm glad to be...
Oh, I'm sorry. Are we doing 3025?
Oh, we're starting with 3015.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was here to speak to 3025, so I'm in the wrong place. I'll step away.
You're in the right place, just the wrong time.
Yeah, thank you, sir.
This is head of you to there, McGee.
Sorry.
So I will go there.
You can stay there if you want. Rep. Gallegos, please.
Chair
Debro,
members of the committee. For the record, Joe Gallegos, House Representative, District 30. Which is Hillsborough and Incorporated Washington County. House Bill 3015 is designed to prohibit public universities from giving student information to credit card companies without student consent. So that's basically what it's about. The effects of credit cards are devastating on students. They end up with about over $3,000 in credit card debt each year. So the concern of this bill then would not only protect their private information from being sold or given or sold to credit card companies, it would also prohibit credit card companies from advertising in school publications. So the notion behind this bill then is to limit then that kind of access to students, but more of concern is really the privacy of students and protecting privacy of students. So I hope you'll join me in supporting this bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. This is actually my first time appearing in front of this committee. It is, however, a committee I follow with some interest. I actually think that the work that is happening in this committee, this session, is some of the more consequential work that's happening overall. I think it's some of the more intellectually interesting. And I want you to know that just because a lot of us are not necessarily in front of you every day, we're not boring you, does not mean we don't appreciate what you're doing and the magnitude of what you're doing. Let me talk today, I'm going to talk about a few of the bills that are here today, but House Bill 3015, I have a slightly similar but slightly different take from my colleague. I suppose I technically can qualify as Generation Y or Millennial, I think I'm pretty old for that. But I'm told the kids these days, Facebook generation, etc., don't seem to care as much about privacy as their predecessors. Is that true or not? I don't know. But I think there's something to it. My concern with the issue and my support of House Bill 3015 derives not so much from my concern about privacy, but I feel that the way students are graduating increasingly with increasing loads of debt, that essentially funneling their private information to credit card companies is, in a sense, double down on the problem. And when students are already graduating with record levels of debt, that is a trend that I think is unlikely to abate in the near future, or the foreseeable future. Having them graduate with more than $3,000 on average of credit card debt really is not the direction we need to go in. This is a very modest and prudent step. I think we all understand that there are a lot of benefits to students establishing credit, establishing lines of credit while in school. No doubt about that. I'm not trying to preclude that in any way, shape, or form. But I think this is a reasonable balance to strike. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Gorsuch?
Yes. Well, I just want to echo what my colleagues have said. The thing that I think is most important to consider about the bill, though, is the vulnerability of the population. Obviously, they're adults. Obviously, they can make choices. But I don't think that we should aid in suggesting the development of even more debt. And there's a huge temptation for students at this time in their life, especially when so many of them do need aid, there's a very large temptation to run up credit card debt. And so I think that this bill would help to kind of forestall some of that. So I'm in support of it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I have a comment and a question. You know, one is, you know, we've heard about, you know, the acute crisis of student debt in general, and that in the Oregon University system, the average debt load is somewhere around $25,000. But that is, if I can use the term public debt, it doesn't include private debt like credit card. And I think that is increasingly a problem for students. So I do have a question. With the bill prohibits advertising in an official publication, including an online publication. Does that include student newspaper or, you know, student magazines?
It would, yes.
Okay.
And just to clarify, too, I think to recognize that this isn't really so much a prohibitive, rather than it allows students to volunteer. They have to sign off, in other words. So they can be accessed by credit card companies. However, it's really a voluntary kind of thing. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
One more comment, just to weigh in, something that I think we're touching on. But I think that the private debt, as you referred to it, the distinction between public and private debt, which is it's a good one. Something else, a recent confluence, is these certain changes to the federal bankruptcy code, making it harder to discharge credit card debt in personal bankruptcy, I think is also a factor here. And that's, I think it also heightens the need for some modest legislative action to, I think, rebalance things.
Well, it's already impossible to to erase student debt
Correct.
With bankruptcy.
Yes.
So this would just make it consistent. Right? Sorry. Rep. Gilliam, do you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't understand the need for the bill. This is America, and we bombard kids at the earliest age with advertising, marketing. We just said they're adults, and they need to learn. I hate credit card come-ons. I throw them away. What is it when you get rid of them? I shredded them for a time because I my shredder broke. I understand that. But at what point do the kids, you call them kids, have the personal responsibility to read this and understand? At what point do their parents, who are paying part of the bill and work with them on their loans, step in and go, you don't want to go down this road? This just seems preposterous for us to say, we're going to get a hold of student debt, tuition, books, and all of it that piles up, by protecting these kids from this. I just don't know, at what point do we stop? I'm in another committee where it's the government's fault that people who fall prey to the lottery are falling prey to the lottery. When is it that we say, okay, you're old enough to be on your own, take personal responsibility, and not dig a ditch of debt?
Again, this is not a bill that would prohibit people from getting credit cards, students from getting credit cards. It would make it, it would require the universities to have students sign off to say that they want to receive that information. So, you know, again, it is treating them as adults. But it really, again, I think the privacy piece is really the important piece to me, but I think but the practice of selling information, the practice of getting credit card information and selling it to other vendors is something that is a concern. So, and that's part of what we're trying to get at.
Chair Dembro and Representative Gilliam, thank you for the question. You know, this watching you just now, it was a harken back to the 2009 Committee on Consumer Protection with the same committee administrator and also Representative Gilliam and Representative Wisnett. We had a lot of bills, I think, that hit that nerve for many of us. I think your criticism of the bill is a valid one. In fact, I think there are two good and powerful ways to criticize this bill and this type of legislation. One is the one you mentioned on individual liberty, personal sovereignty, unnecessary regulation. The other that hasn't come up yet, but I think I want to acknowledge, is certain First Amendment or free speech grounds, prohibition of advertising, et cetera. It's commercial speech. That's another, I think, valid criticism of this bill. And I think that... we might just simply disagree on where to draw the line. I think most of us would agree that some regulation of financial institutions, and how, period, but also as they intersect with the student population, is appropriate. Where is that line drawn? I think reasonable people could differ. I think for some of the reasons we've previously discussed, the increase of student debt, public and private, the changes in the bankruptcy code, I think it is time to, shall we say, redraw that line slightly more in this direction. But to the extent this committee disagrees, I understand that. It's reasonable people, I think, could differ on where that line should be drawn.
Right, let's hear from another reasonable representative here. Representative Wisson.
Could I respond to Rep.
Sure. If you hold
Rep. Wilson.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, thanks for appearing this morning. And
the other way, sir.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Go ahead. It's all right, Gene.
Rep. Gorsuch's not going anywhere.
I'll come back.
To the bill, students need credit cards. Even my son, who's 40 years old, had to have a credit card. You're going to have credit cards. I'm not sure you've identified in your testimony, maybe you can provide testimony, how big is the problem, how much money the chair mentioned that you're going to cost the school newspapers advertising dollars. I think you're trying to address an issue. I tried for three sessions to introduce a bill that would require personal financial management as a graduation requirement back in the high schools. You've got to educate people and not take away their liberties. So thank you.
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Rep. Gilliam. The only thing I would, certainly see your concern. It makes a lot of sense. The one thing I would say, though, is that we regulate student information very, very closely. And, you know, with FERPA and what we can and can't release, I mean, I see it all the time at my school. We can just about release their name, and that's about it. So I would caution on that side. And so for me, it's more that issue of not losing or giving out that information. It seems to be in keeping with other FERPA ideas. But I do hear what you're saying about personal responsibility and all of that. Thank you.
Rick Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To build on some of the comments that my esteemed colleague to the left down here made earlier, about the information age, which isn't any new thing, certainly, but my daughter started getting Nordstrom credit solicitations, I think, when she turned about 8 or 9. Long ways from college, certainly, and not a part of any database anywhere that I was aware of, but somehow the world knows it. We had a female in the house, and she could potentially be interested in their product. So it's hard for me to see how this legislation is going to forestall that, because obviously these students are known far and wide by the world, basically. My question, I guess, would be, would this bill preclude a financial institution from having a presence on a university campus? Or is it just simply you cannot overtly advertise instruments of credit?
Right. I think the bill, the way it's written, is the overt kind of publication, magazines, that kind of thing. And again, I would emphasize the voluntary nature of this, that students would basically sign off when they register. If they want to receive this information, that's you know, again, up to them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm sorry,
yes,
ma'am.
Please. Go ahead.
First of all, thank you for the comments. I actually don't think this legislature could preclude financial institutions from appearing on campuses. I'm now thinking, I don't, even if we wanted to, which that is not the intent of the bill, as I understand it, certainly not my intent in appearing, I don't think we could. I think what this does do is, what attracts me is it changes the transfer of student information to an opt-in system. Students still want it. They still can opt into it. But really, that's the aspect of this bill that intrigues me, more so than, say, the publication preclusion or anything of that nature. Again, as I mentioned before, I find that has some settling implications that I'm not entirely comfortable with. But as to your, I think, larger and more interesting point about your daughter in Nordstrom's, this bill certainly will not affect that. I don't know. That's clearly a much larger issue that this bill is simply above this bill. I don't know that that's an argument against this bill, the fact that it doesn't deal with a larger problem, but it's an interesting point. I'd be happy to brainstorm some ideas about what, if anything, we could or should. No, you're not.
I'm fine. Stay away.
He's proud that his daughter meets the proper demographic.
Absolutely. Right. It's better than T.J. Maxx.
Yes, Rep. Gallegos.
Yeah, I think one of the objectives of this bill is really to drive students to their financial aid counselors. In other words, one of the functions of financial aid at the university or community college, wherever, is really to reduce the stress on students so they can be successful in the classroom. That's the purpose of providing financial aid. And this bill, the intent then would be to reduce that stress, to keep students so that they can focus on their studies and not be caught up in this kind of debt and stress.
All right, thank you,
sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
Rip Barn, you're going to be testifying on another one.
Oh, you're going to be there.
Just hang out.
Yes. Thank you.
No, yes. Do you want to go ahead and do that now, or I have another panel to bring up. Do you want to just hang out?
Mr. Chair, I'll
okay,
wait for the next bill, if I may.
I appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Okay, so we have a couple of people from the higher education world to testify. Emma Calloway, please, and Bridget Burns.
Good morning, Chair Dembo and members of the committee. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association, and I'm here to testify today in support of House Bill 3015. And students had a lengthy discussion about this, and I want to just highlight a few points after hearing the discussion this morning. So first of all, we think that selling of student information is not something that students are comfortable with. We appreciate the fact that this bill gives students a choice to have access to that information. And right now we know that universities are looking for more creative ways all the time to bring in revenue as we see dwindling state funding and other resources. And we think that this should never be an option for financing of an institution. And so that's the piece about selling of student information. Specifically around the issues of advertising, we think that financial aid offices are the best place to have conversations about financial aid. And we think that advertising about financial options should be about advertising a financial aid officer or financial aid office that can give the entire spectrum of options. That would include credit cards to subsidized loans. And we think that financial aid offices should really be an opportunity to give that kind of gamut. Specifically around university publications, and this is to your question, Representative Gilliam and Representative Johnson, yes, students are adults, and we prefer to be treated that way. But I would say that a university publication holds and implies a more valuable or sound advice. And I think that at the end of the day, we want to make sure that universities are giving the whole spectrum of advice to students and not having direct advertising around credit card companies, which is just one form of financing. And we think specifically that university publications hold a greater weight, and we want to make sure that our students are having the best information they can about financial aid options that really will give them the lowest debt at the end of the day, and will help them have greater financial health over time. So I think I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take any questions, but students are very supportive of this bill and really want to make sure that our universities are advertising and giving students information that's about the whole spectrum of financing options, and particularly whatever options for them will help to lower student debt over time. So, thank you.
Thank you, Emma. Bridget.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. Just want to offer some brief thoughts on this piece of legislation to give you a little background about how we see this interacting with what we do. First, we need you to know that we care deeply about the financial circumstances of our students. We do a lot of work around debt counseling. We do a lot of work around financial aid advising. And we also are very concerned about predatory student loans and the student loan debt that our students graduate with. This is something that is consistently on our radar because we do feel an obligation to make sure that our students are able to use their degrees and that they're getting the money that it's worth it for them in terms of what they end up with financially. First, we don't do this in terms of providing information to credit card lenders. This is not a practice of our institutions, not just because of it just not really being in our wheelhouse, but more that FERPA prevents us from doing this. We have legal obligations to students and to protect our privacy, and we take those very seriously. And I have actually spent a lot of time on this issue because when I was student body president at Oregon State back in 2002, I tried to kick off predatory credit card lenders from campus and prohibit them from being on campus at the time. So I did a lot of research on where this happens because Portland State was successful in 2001 at prohibiting predatory credit card lenders from coming on campus. And what I found out was this is not something that's typically done by the institution. What it is that the alumni associations have a relationship with local credit unions, and they offer a credit card typically that benefits the local alumni association. So that wouldn't necessarily be something that would be impacted by this legislation. And at the time, we tried to prevent them from tabling on campus and primarily all they did was offer tabling on game days because they were trying to target alumni. So that's what I know about what actually is happening right now. We do have a few questions that I want to offer, looking for clarification. Happy to work with the bill sponsors to either clarify or amend legislation. The first is about student directories. We do publish student directories that don't provide private or confidential information, but we do feel like letting the public know and or letting folks know that they are a student at our institution is an important role that we play. And further, we would argue that it's important to know that students have currently the ability to restrict that information from being published. All they have to do is fill out a form, and their information is not going to be published in the student directory. Second, we do have some questions about the fiscal implication of this bill, just in terms of having to seek written consent from every single student to make sure that their information is not being shared when, again, we already don't provide that information because of FERPA. Just a little bit more clarity about what that would take in terms of actual human workload. Finally, I just want to offer a little background in terms of the Higher One card, which is currently offered on the Southern Oregon University and Portland State University campus. The Higher One card is not a credit card. It is a debit card, and we use it in order to provide financial aid resources to students in an expedited fashion. Not only does it save us money because it doesn't cost the dollar, I believe it costs to print a check, but students get their financial aid resources immediately when they hit their account. This is really really important in the first weeks of campus when students need to get their student their books and get things when they're first registered. So this is something that is present on two of our campuses. It does save money, but it is only a debit card. And I would offer that there needs to be perhaps a little bit more clarification in the definition of the word credit card, because from what I have here, there's an or statement that maybe we could think about eliminating. It's instrument or device by means of which a person may obtain for or obtain on credit goods and services. The or statement could present an issue. It's not a big issue, but I just want to offer up that our institutions take this issue very seriously, and we're doing things all the time to reduce cost. You're going to hear a little bit about that later on today. This is one of those areas, which is providing an expedited way and an inexpensive way to get resources to students quickly, and we would just want to make sure that this bill does not create any problems for that. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yes, for a course.
I just want to go back to the card. Do students have to pay a fee for that card?
Chair Dembro, Representative Gorsuch, I do not believe they do. That's something that there was an initial setup fee years ago. I believe this started in 2004, 2003 on Portland State's campus, I remember. But no, I don't believe it costs anything to the student, but I will get back to you with that information.
I'd be curious about that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Emma, you want to address the higher one?
Yeah, if I could, Emma Calloway, Chair Dembro and Representative Gorsuch, there are considerable fees associated with the higher one card that have to do with transferring of funds and the use of the card. And so I think that Bridget and I could both get you information on the upfront fee, but I would say that one of the largest complaints about students at SOU and PSU on a constant basis is the fees associated with each transaction of different use of the card and moving money on and off of it. And I want to clarify that this bill is not about higher one, but students at some point would love to come and have a conversation with you about higher one, because it does not make us happy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rick Wisner.
Thank you. Mr. Burns, I'd have a couple of things I'd need to vote on this. You need to tell us, you made a statement that OUS does not do this. They do not sell the list. I think that's what these people intended, the bill's trying to do, is stop selling the list. You're saying no one in the Oregon University system sells the list to credit card companies?
Chair Dembro, Representative Wisnett, that is correct based on the information that was provided. I sent this bill out and asked for feedback, and I would point out that what I do think that we're looking at here is the publication of directories. That information can be publicly obtained, and it's possible that that information could be what you're talking about, that credit card lenders might be getting a hold of. I'm not entirely certain, because this was not brought to us as something where we get consistent complaints. This legislation was not brought to us initially.
My colleague would ask us to also, we'll check with community college and see if that's their policy. Could you give this committee impact of not being able to advertise in your publications or on online? And I respect all of my colleagues, but it seems like that is a freedom of speech issue that I don't think this bill needs to make it try to do what it's trying to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rick Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was sitting here thinking about Bridget's testimony and that part of the bill somewhat being moot, because you don't do what the bill suggests you shouldn't do anyway. I just think it's inappropriate for the legislature to be sandwiching ourselves in between an adult and commerce. I don't think we have any business being there, and that's my 2 cents. Two and a half.
Well, if I could just respond to that. I mean, in a sense, the university or the community college may well be sandwiching itself to the extent that it's enabling a certain practice. I don't know. If it's, if it is providing the information, and perhaps it currently is not, it has in the past, presumably, and, perhaps it will again in the future.
No Republicans on there.
Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you. Here's one more question. I'm still confused. Emma, I heard you say that the students were concerned about the university actually marketing or selling data. And then I'm hearing from Bridget that doesn't occur. Could we clear that up before you both leave the panel here, please? Which it either is or isn't. I mean, it either happens or it doesn't happen.
Chair Dembro and Representative Johnson, I wanted to say that students don't want that to be happening. It is not my understanding that it is currently happening, but it is happening in other states. And what the point I wanted to make is that universities are looking for ways to bring in additional revenue, and we don't want this to be on the table ever for an option of bringing in additional funds.
That helps. Thank you.
Yes, Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, both of you. For me, Mr. Chair, these two witnesses just made an excellent case for why this is a great issue at the local, I can say it that way, individual campus level. I appreciate your experience when you're a student body president. How many student body presidents in the room? And secondly, we are looking, you know, what is the old cliche? We're a solution in search of a problem. I mean, I don't know what we're trying to fix here if we don't do it, and there is robust.
Did I say it well?
Now to say about the university, the portal, the.
Excuse me, my counsel's good. So anyway, I think this is an excellent issue for students to struggle with. Campus by campus. I understand the privacy issue. I appreciate the testimony on that. What I don't like is moving into we're going to somehow solve student debt here today with this bill.
The birth data.
Oh, that other bill. I'll get to that later. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. Gilliam. Rep. Gorsuch.
Again, I fully understand what Rep. Gilliam is saying, but I am concerned.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I'm trying to be, you know, I want to be collegial.
And I appreciate it.
But I do worry. I know it's not a problem right now here, but I do worry about the precedent being set in other places. And so just something, and especially with the First Amendment questions that my good colleague, Representative Wisnett, has, I think there are some things that we could do to work on this bill. But the basic idea of protecting the student, it's a possibility, and just to have a general policy that says we shouldn't do that, I think doesn't harm anybody. But obviously this bill would have some work that would need to be done, especially for some of my colleagues to be able to support it.
Thank you, Representative.
I have one question about it has to do with the comment, Bridget, you made about the cost. I mean, when students register, don't they fill out registration forms? I mean, couldn't there just simply be a question on there, do you wish to share this information or not? I think you said that there already is something like that.
Chair Dembrough, Representative Gallegos, yes, I believe that we provide currently up front the opportunity for students to indicate they don't want to be published in our campus-wide directories. So I think just clarification about exactly where the policy nexus is in terms of this legislation and that practice, that would be helpful for us. But I don't, our interpretation was this: we were going to have to individually seek out everyone who's currently a student who has already filled the paperwork out long ago. Are you sure? And, you know, there's a lot of other stuff we are working on at the time. Okay. But I would just say, ultimately, that this practice is not consistent with our values. And so it's hard for me to anticipate a time where the Oregon University system would be, you know, trying to sell this information to credit card lenders, where, again, we have heightened concerns about the student financials when they leave our institutions, making sure that they're on strong footing.
Can I follow up?
Yes, please.
I just want to thank you then. I think you did clarify some issues and sort of point out some areas that we could rewrite or make this better. And I do want to thank my colleagues on the committee as well for their comments.
Thank you. And let me say, of course, colleagues, you know that we're in the midst of conversations around the governance of higher education that could, you know, dramatically change the way issues like this are regarded, where, you know, the practice of the OUS that is currently a system decision, you know, could devolve on the individual campuses. So I think to that extent, I think this is a timely conversation. So thank you very both for coming. We have one more witness, and this is a representative from the industry, Mr. Tim Martinez.
Good Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just so I don't get in trouble with the Ethics Commission, I'm not sure I'm here representing the industry, but I am here representing the Oregon Bankers Association. So, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3015. I just want to start by saying I'm the proud parent. My wife and I are of a sophomore at the University of Oregon. I'm the proud owner of some student debt of that student. And I'm also here to say that I have no idea how he's doing in that school because I can't get any information from the university because he's over 18. So I assume he's doing well. He doesn't feel the need to share his grades with us anymore or to let us know what's going on. He is very helpful when I show up before the beginning of every quarter and pull out my credit card and pay for his books. He has no problem with that. So, again, I would like to have some information, so I will talk to the University of Oregon, see if they can tell me how my son's doing down there, because they have a very strong privacy protection policy in place, and I have no doubt that it goes to this issue as well. You know, historically, I did in college, maybe many of you did, that's where I got my first credit card. It generally had a low limit. Most of them are, you know, under $1,000, $500, $750 maybe. In many cases, you need your parent to co-sign with you. So at that point, if they are co-signing, you do have the ability to keep an eye and monitor it and make sure they're not getting into trouble. I'm certainly not here to suggest that some do get in trouble. Clearly, that occurs. But, you know, the way I think the association looks at it is this is an opportunity for them to start down the credit path that they're going to be on their whole life. You know, whether good or bad or indifferent, they are going to have a credit history their whole life. And this is a way to do it in a manner that shouldn't cause them a lot of hardship if they live up to their obligations. Again, using my son as an example, I'm sure he's not listening. I'm hoping he's in class, but he's probably not out of bed yet, frankly. You know, he did get notified by a credit card company, and unbeknownst to his parents, at least I don't think his mother knows, but sometimes mothers and fathers don't tell the whole stories to each other about their kids. He did get a credit card, and he ran it up to the max within weeks. You know, he was taking all his friends out to dinner and all sorts of things, and it was maxed out within weeks. And he made minimum payments for a couple months and realized, you know what, this isn't getting me anywhere. So when he came home last summer and got his summer job, the first thing he did with that check was pay off that credit card, and he's learned a valuable lesson: pay that thing off every month, and you know your life will be much more simplified. So I do agree with Representative Barton that this is a good, you know, establishing credit is important, and college is a good place to do it, and there are resources there that can help them, help the students, even though they're adults, make sure that they don't get into trouble. Our specific concerns, there was a little discussion, I think, about on-site branches. I know of at least one institution, one bank, and then there's probably other institutions that do have branches on-site, and I got to tell you, you know, if especially for the freshmen, bankers are belts and suspenders type individuals. You know, they check, double check, and if there's any doubt in their mind, they default to no. We probably all heard that before from them or about them. So there is some concern from some institutions about what that does to on-site branching, whether they'd be able to do that, whether they'd be able to market all of their banking products. So I would ask you to consider that. And kind of as a secondary piece to that, if the committee, and it sounds like Representative Gallegos is looking at some potential amendments, that you do consider at least dropping the advertising piece. And you know, putting in the student newspaper and other publications that do get handed out on campus, because I think that would make it very, very tough. And the last thing I think anybody would want would be for an institution to say, you know what, this branch doesn't make any sense anymore, and we're going to have to close the branch. Now, as far as the specifics of the bill, there was the Credit Card Act of 2009 that passed Congress that deals with truth in lending. For those of you that can't sleep at night, it's H.R. 627, and the specific site is Section 304, and that deals specifically with the credit card protection for college students. And it says, and I'm paraphrasing, so please, if Representative Barton's behind me, don't let him tell me I didn't read it word for word, because I'm not going to do that. But credit card protections for college students. The university shall publicly disclose any contract made between them and a credit card issue for marketing purposes. So that's already out there. No issuer or creditor may offer any tangible item to induce a student to apply or participate in a program. The days are gone when you can go to a tailgate elevator at Oxen and have Visa or MasterCard or anybody there advertising their wares and saying, here's a free football or whatever. This is prohibited under that. It's not only prohibited on campus, near campus, and also advanced sponsorship. Those are now all out. They also suggest in the bill, there's a sense of Congress, that the university, a university should include the policies and any card marketing contracts and where, the number of locations that these places may be held, and also, which is equally important that was touched on briefly here, but I think really needs to be considered, you know, the OBA and others for a long time have talked about financial literacy. You know, we've argued that it ought to be part of the curriculum in K through 12. I look around the dais here, and except for Representative Gilly, who I think is still in his 20s, we all probably had financial literacy in high school. He was student body president, so he was too busy for that class. But, you know, we all had financial literacy of some sort when we went to school. That doesn't occur anymore. And I realize it's tough to teach our kids everything they need to learn. But, you know, we strongly advocate for financial literacy and financial education to be put in the K through 12, and I think that would alleviate a lot of this problem.
I want to point out, when I came up at that time, we had just come off the gold standard.
It's been downhill ever since.
Mr. Okay. Chair, Representative, I did include the whole diocese. The last thing I would say as you consider this bill is in some major bank legislation a couple of years ago in Congress, there was the creation of the Consumer Finance Protection Board, which is now up and running. The Congress has never seen fit to vote on a director, but a director continues to serve with a recess appointment. And this is one issue that they are looking very deeply at and are drafting rules on. So I would also suggest and ask very respectfully that you consider waiting and see what these folks come up with before we move forward. The last thing we want to have happen is for Oregon to be, you know, out of line with what the feds do. And I think I can say without fear of mistake that the Consumer Finance Protection Board will go at least as far as the Oregon State Legislature would. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Martinez. Rep. Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm being totally serious. Mr. Martinez touched on it a bit, but, you know, with all of my kids, bar none, the credit card situation in college was, they probably remember that experience. They learned from that experience more than any other class. They can't tell you what their sophomore English, you know, but they remember the lesson they learned to this very day about credit card debt. And I, in a often sad sort of way, I think it's a valuable experience. And as 30-plus year old adults today, not a one of the eight have a credit card problem because they did learn that, geez, how do I pay that $2,000 off? So I do think it's an unwritten part of the curriculum.
Yes, thank you, Rep. Huffman. And I appreciate that, and I appreciate everything that Mr. Martinez has said. But I do want to throw out the perspective that, you know, I've experienced firsthand, not you know, for myself, but with the students that I've taught over the years. You know, at the community college, we have a lot of people who are not kids. And they don't have their parents to fall back on when they get into a little trouble, you know, with credit card, nor do they really have the guidance, you know, of parents to help them. And, you know, I'm thinking particularly of people, you know, in their mid-20s, late-20s, who've, you know, made some poor decisions in their life to begin with. They come back to school, they're ready to turn their lives around, and they're... you know, frankly, for the first time in their lives, they're seduced by credit. They're in a position where they're looking at being able, you know, they foresee an ability to earn money because of the, you know, the studies that they're in the middle of, and they get into a lot of trouble. And so, you know, none of that, I think, you know, precludes anything that's been said already, but I just want you all to be thinking of that perspective and that problem as well.
Mr. Martinez, I really appreciate your comments, and I'm assuming that your testimony is written up for us
Chair Dember, Representative Gallegos, the answer to that is no, but I would be happy to come set an appointment with you and sit and chat with you
please
if you think that would be helpful.
I do want to say that this class and this financial information that people talk about getting in school, my wife never got that. She never got that. And so my wife tends to go crazy with her credit cards. But to the point, I think what I do want to say is really I want to appreciate your bringing the industries or the banks perspective. I think what this discussion really represents is, and I want you to appreciate it and others to appreciate how much the legislature is really trying to look at every aspect to get at the 40-40-20, to get our students graduated, to get them out of school and into productive lives. So, I mean, I think this is an example of maybe, you know, really getting down in the weeds and really trying to find ways that we can do that. But at the same time, wanting to respect individual rights as well as the needs for commerce. And so this is our struggle. So thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gallegos, if I could just go off point just for a minute. I absolutely agree with everything you're saying. You know, my son made some very good friends his freshman year who didn't come back their second year at Oregon. Very, very smart kids, but simply couldn't afford it. I mean, we're pricing our kids out of education. And I want to make it very clear, if it wasn't in my earlier testimony, we would never suggest an individual fund their college on the backs of a credit card. I mean, unless they're going to be a Steve Jobs or a Gates or somebody's going to invent something to make a lot of money very quickly, or the Facebook individual, a lot of money very quickly, that's not going to happen or be anything that makes sense. And then lastly, just in case my wife ever listens to my testifying, in my house, I'm the one and she's the one that actually pays attention to credit card stuff. So she knows I'm the one that can get out of control. Thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Martinez.
That's cheap pandering.
35 years.
Okay, colleagues, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3015. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3025. And Victoria, would you please tell us about this, which I think also has to do with affordability, but in a different way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3025 establishes the Next Generation Fund, directs the state tax revenue to Next Generation Fund, appropriates monies to Oregon University System to fund higher education and to Department of Education to fund early childhood education programs, applies to revenues received by Department of Revenue on or after January 1, 2015, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die.
Thank you, Victoria. Hello again, reps. Rep Gorsuch, you going to start?
Sure. Unless you want to go?
No.
Okay.
After you.
Finally, I'm in the right place at the right time. Here we go. And my testimony is being passed around right now. So once again, good morning, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch. I'm the state rep of House District 49, which includes Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and Gresham, as well as a small piece of East Portland. I'm glad to be here this morning to speak with you in support of House Bill 3025, which would help create a more stable funding mechanism for early childhood education programs and our higher education system. As we all know, our education system in Oregon is not where it should be. That's an understatement. Our graduation rates are the fourth lowest in the nation, and the task of funding our universities and colleges is increasingly being put on the backs of our students. It is our responsibility to ensure that we're doing everything within our power to ensure that students here in Oregon are given an education that will prepare them for life after graduating from high school or from community college or one of our universities. By establishing the Next Generation Fund, we can take a step toward a stable funding system for early education programs and our colleges and universities. So why is this program important? First, research shows that early childhood education programs contribute significantly towards success in school. Students who take part in early childhood education programs are more likely to complete four-year degrees, hold higher-paying jobs, and have more stable lives as adults.
Reynolds High School, which is in my district, has one of the lowest graduation rates in Oregon at the present time. So providing early childhood education programs to students in the Reynolds District would set them on a path for success and help us reach our 40-40-20 goals in East Multnomah County. Second, as a professor at Mountain Community College, I see firsthand the impact of the lack of education funding for our colleges and universities. Since the beginning of the recession, college enrollment has jumped over 30%, while state funding has dropped by 20%. From 2007 to 2012, Oregon experienced the 10th largest drop in per-student public support, a 32% decrease. Only four states provided less public support per student. Yet tuition in Oregon is about 20% above the national average, while student assistance efforts have lagged behind the national average by 20%. Needless to say, our education system is in need of stable and increased funding. While this bill will not solve all of our problems, it can help provide us the opportunities that students throughout the state of Oregon deserve. The one thing I would point out, too, about this is that the bill actually focuses by direct statement on early childhood ed and higher ed, but I always think of community colleges as part of higher ed, so definitely community colleges needs to be added into this. So at any rate, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Rep. Gorsuch. Rep. Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough and members of the committee. Joe Gallegos, for the record, House District 30. Next Generation Fund, being the academic that I am, I Googled this term and came up with all kinds of things. Primarily, though, across the country, basically they seem to be a lot of scholarship endowment kinds of funds to support students. So that's what this is, and I think that Representative Gorsuch's information, I think, in terms of the research and support, I think is well stated. Again, to me, this is another bill that would help us get to the 40-40-20 that is aimed at providing a dedicated fund that would be used then specifically for both ends of our education system, for early childhood as well as college funds. So I think it's been stated, and I think the bill is a good one. So we're open for questions.
Great, thank you. So just to clarify, so what we're talking about here is a dedicated use of the estate tax.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
And the concept being using the estate tax to invest in the next generation.
Exactly. And that way, this would not call for any new taxes, not call for any new revenue. It would simply dedicate the existing resource.
Okay, thank you. So just a follow-up. Do we have any sense of how much this might raise?
I don't know. Do we?
No. Again, it's not a revenue-generating bill. It will simply use the existing estate tax that's coming in.
So it all depends upon when people end up in that particular situation where that tax kicks in. So it's hard to know. Well, yeah. I was trying to be more friendly about it.
I'm not.
No. Chris says no.
Questions?
Okay, right. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Thank you. You bet. May I say that you all look marvelous from down here. It's amazing, especially Rep. Gilliam.
It's the first thing I agreed with.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we have Jody Weiser.
I think she'll know the answer to that question.
This is an unusual circumstance, me being in front of this committee so frequently. For the record, Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. So this concept was actually a concept that a group of that Tax Fairness Oregon and a whole coalition of people began working on in 2007. And the the purpose was to make people feel better about paying their estate taxes. And in fact, I've been waiting for this thing to happen so that I can say to people, you don't have to go to the Oregon Community Foundation and set up a whole new system, because the state has a system to pass out money to needy kids. And we understand the desire to do this, because you know you're doing it for your grandchildren. So why wouldn't you want to do it for other people's? And it's compelling. It's compelling to the person with money to say, I'm going to help out the underclass whose kids don't get to go to preschool unless they get into a Head Start program, and whose kids need it because they're not often in a rich word environment or a curiosity environment like our own children are raised in. And we're concerned about the needs of kids that are coming out of college with huge debt. I would bet that if you asked the whole population how they feel about college debt for kids, it is the people who pay the estate tax who would have the most knowledge about it, would be most accurate in their knowledge about it, because it concerns them. And so I think it's a great way to make people not feel angry about giving up a piece of their money, because it's the same as setting up a foundation. You know, we know that one of our huge woodland owners started a program that we're all proud to know we're in a state where a lot of kids from rural communities get really significant help with their college education because of the fund that was funded. It used to be we got really good information about the estate tax, and there was a year when the percentage of giving jumped way above, you know, the dollars per, the percent of the money that had gone to charitable giving was way above average, but the number of people who happened to die that year and paid the estate tax was actually quite low. And so I asked one of our researchers, can you figure out who this is? And that's when that was started. That's when that fund was started that's been giving so many kids help with college. And we all know the value of early childhood education, and having been a Head Start teacher myself, I can tell you that one of the advantages of Head Start is that it has a longer day and has far more interaction with the parents. Parents who have failed in school come to school and help their kids succeed, and that's really important to the success of that whole family, not just the child. And so my only concern about House Bill 3025 is that I think it would be helpful if it was more specific and it said the money is going to the Oregon Opportunity Grant program that funds, helps with the cost of college for our lower income Oregonians going to the Oregon schools and to Head Start and early Head Start. We currently spend about $100 million a biennium on Oregon Opportunity Grants, and I don't know what the Head Start budget is, but I'm sure it's probably more than that. And early Head Start is underfunded, and that gets to get the younger children. And so I don't think that we're going to have any extra outflow. We're just directing it and making people feel proud of what they're doing. And the estate tax revenue, if I'm recalling right from last November when I was working on Measure 84, is about $200 million a biennium. It is very irregular. It goes up and down. But if you look back historically, it's in every biennium, it's pretty even. But one year will be high and the other will be low. So there will be need to be some work to buy the institutions that handle the money to keep it level so that you don't go up and down, up and down. But right now, kids getting Oregon Opportunity Grants, only 20% of the kids who are eligible get it. And they get it one year, and they don't know if they'll ever get it again. And so, you know, I guess it wouldn't affect that program that much. Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. And I appreciate that suggestion of directing it to the Opportunity Grant. Rip Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
No, this
is off to the next meeting.
Often happens to me, actually.
I think it's probably about your age. It was probably a noun you lost.
Yeah. I
appreciate your comments and your point of view. My question would be, is it conceivable to you that there are individuals in our state who, through careful planning, estate planning, might set up an Oregon Community Grant or some other device, and they would find great pride and satisfaction in knowing that, for instance, half of their estate went to their alma mater that they credit with their success? Or maybe they didn't go to college and they're very proud of their grandkids going to, just pick a college out of the blue,
I think Pacific University got $6 million and it was a total surprise.
So that part, and perhaps picking on their own a Head Start program in their community or an early childhood education at their church. Don't you think that there are individuals conceivably in Oregon who would find a great deal of satisfaction, I would even say more satisfaction, out of doing that kind of planning and directing their own estate that they worked on, rather than asking the state of Oregon and having the satisfaction that you
I think that there are absolutely many people who do that. My understanding is that there will be no estate tax paid when Phil Knight passes, and it's going to create a foundation. And it would be lovely if that foundation would fund the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, but I don't actually have access to his ear.
He hasn't said a word to me about it.
Well, good. I don't feel left out there.
My wife.
But, I mean, there a lot of people do that, but a lot of other people are really hesitant to get around to doing estate tax planning. I mean, I have a wonderful friend who is very adverse to paying taxes. And I asked, and he doesn't believe in the estate tax. And I said, well, Paul, what are you going to do with your money? He never thought about it. And he still said, well, I guess I'd just leave it to my ex-wife. And I said, well, did you leave her in trouble? You know, did you leave her without enough money? What would she do it? And so then we talked some more, and he is now put his estate going to the gospel mission. And so, you know, he's done the work that he needed to do. But a lot of people don't get around to the work, and this would make them feel much better about what's happening. And frankly, it's a good employment prospect for middle-income people if there's lots of little funds, but it gets less money to the students.
Thank you, Jody. Rep. Greenlick, and then we're going to have to move on.
Yeah, I just want to comment on what Greg Gilliland said. That person that's going to set up that fund is doing it in a way that it will reduce their estate taxes. I mean, I know that's the case because in setting up my will, when I told my lawyer I want to pay full estate taxes because for a variety of reasons, he sent along with my will a letter saying that I had disregarded his advice on how to reduce the estate tax. So, I mean, I think if they go about setting up an estate and setting up a trust and setting up the, they generally are doing it in a way that their taxable estate gets minimized pretty significantly, and that's a good thing.
Okay, thank you, colleagues, for this discussion. Jody, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3025. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 104.
Can I ask a question before you? If there's any sense to move this, will there be an effort to make amendments?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. So I'm going to call Jan McComb, and while she's coming up, Victoria, could you tell us about this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 104 allows the Department of Education to require background checks of community college faculty members providing instruction as part of early childhood education programs, declares an emergency effective July 1, 2013.
Okay, Jan, tell me why you want to fingerprint me, please.
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jan McComb, the Legislative Director for the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 104. It's one of the department's bills. Student safety has been a priority for the legislature and the department for a long time, and Senate Bill 104 increases that safety by expanding who in a school is subject to a state and national criminal background check. As you probably recall, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission conducts criminal background checks on all licensed personnel. Those are teachers, administrators, nurses, and personnel specialists. But the Oregon Department of Education conducts criminal background checks on non-licensed personnel. That would be the office staff, bus drivers, custodial staff, contractors, and so on. Not too long ago, the legislature added community college faculty members who teach in a K-12 setting to those who must undergo a criminal background check. Senate Bill 104 will add community college faculty members who provide instruction as part of an early childhood education program, such as Oregon Head Start. Many community colleges offer degrees and certificates in early childhood education. The community college students participate in practicums that take them into early childhood education classrooms. The students are background checked, but their teachers who come into the classroom to observe their students' teaching are not. Senate Bill 104 closes this loophole and better ensures the safety of Oregon's youngest students by ensuring that all staff members have undergone a background check. The Dash 1 amendment before you is really non-substantive. We looked at the wording and we just tweaked it a little bit to better clarify our intent. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Jan, how did this bill do over on the Senate side?
Thank you for asking, Chair Dimbrough. The Senate vote was 29-0. And it came out of committee unanimously as well.
Who was hiding?
Anybody have any questions about this?
Straightforward.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Jan. Is there anyone here who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 104, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 104. Vice Chair Huffman.
Chair Dimbrough, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated March 12, 2013.
Vice Chair Huffman moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 12, 2013. Any discussion of the amendments? Any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Huffman.
Chair Dimbrough, I move Senate Bill 104 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Huffman moves Senate Bill 104 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of the bill? Rep. Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, I would put you on the spot and just ask you to say a little bit about a bill you're obviously supporting because of your background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I myself would not fall into this category,
right.
Because I don't, as part of my job, go to a K-12 or pre-K setting. My colleagues would, and I think, many of them are coming out of the world of K-12 or, have worked closely in that setting. So, I think my sense is they feel comfortable with this.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to this bill?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then Senate Bill 104 is passed as amended.
There was an amendment, I wouldn't put it on the consent
calendar. It'd be nice to put it on the consent calendar.
Why would you put it on the consent calendar?
Because there was an amendment, it's going to have to go for concurrence.
I don't know if you heard that. Just because there was an amendment, this will have to go back to the Senate for concurrence. So it's best to have it explained on the floor.
Okay.
Rep. Greenlick will carry it. Thank you, sir.
Great.
Okay. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 104. And at long last, colleagues, I know what you've been waiting for. Our good, esteemed colleague, Jay Kenton.
I'm going to open the informational hearing on the issue of the cost drivers of higher education. And Jay's going to be focusing specifically on the universities, OUS.
Credit history.
He didn't opt in.
Yes.
Good morning, Mr. Bay members. For the record, I'm Jay Kenton, Vice Chancellor of Finance for the Oregon University System. And I'm here today to present to you on cost drivers. And this is kind of a follow-up discussion. I did the same presentation last February, I believe it was. And so I've updated it for a year. And but some of you who have carried over with this committee have maybe seen parts of it before. So what I want to talk about is cost drivers first to two different entities, if you will. One to students, because that's very important in my opinion, and one to institutions. And the two are related, obviously, but I think as you hear this presentation, you'll understand those relationships better. For students, the number one driver of tuition is the level of state appropriation, and that's not just in Oregon, that's across the country. And I'm going to show you some data on that. And when I talk about tuition in this presentation, I'm only going to talk about resident undergraduate tuition, because I think that's the part that we're most concerned about, that our people can afford to get a college education. And when I get into institutions, I'll talk about, you know, demand, enrollment quality, et cetera, and cost driven by other factors. This first chart is just a history of our appropriations, how it's broken down by different types, be it, you know, the ENG, which is both general funds and federal funds. When we got the economic stimulus money in the last couple biennia, that was actually treated as though it were state money. That was how we were directed, even though it was really federally earmarked money to, you know, hold the recovery, et cetera. So it shows up in this presentation as that lower blue bar. There's debt service appropriations, and I know there's a growing concern with this body about the level of those appropriations kind of eating into operating dollars, if you will. And then the capital construction, sometimes, not often, but sometimes we get direct state appropriations for capital. The statewide public services are discrete appropriations. That's the Agriculture Experiment Station, the Forest Research Laboratory, and the Extension Service at Oregon State University, the land grant mission, if you will, and then the sports lottery funds. And you can see that's kind of gone up and gone down over time. So when we talk about tuition and state funding, as I mentioned, it's the single largest factor in driving tuition. And SHEO, the State Higher Ed Executive Officers, and their finance branch, which is SHEF, State Higher Ed Executive Finance Officers, have just come out that Oregon is now 46th in the country in state funding per student. And that's community colleges, higher ed, OHSU, all combined, looking at similar portfolios across the country. We're 46. And I've been working with Secretary of State auditors on an affordability kind of performance audit. And one of the things that came up, they started looking at our costs. They started looking at our funding. And this bottom chart, actually, I took kind of from them. They looked at resident tuition, unadjusted on the left side of this chart, unadjusted for inflation. Then they adjusted it to 2012 dollars, and they found that after adjusting to 2012 dollars, it's gone up 62% more than inflation, which is cause for concern, I believe. And it's $2,380 more.
Sir, would you explain that again. I'm sorry, sir. I didn't understand what you're saying.
So if you look on the left side, that 3170, what they have done is adjusted it forward to 2012 dollars. They took those $2,003 changed by the rate of the CPI, right, and rolled it forward into 2012 dollars on the right-hand side. And that equals that 3857 number then, right?
Yes.
And then we contrast that to our actual, these are, by the way, average tuition rates for a student K carrying 15 hours a quarter at all seven of our institutions. I didn't weight the average based on the number of students at each institution, it's just a straight average of the rates. And then if you do the same thing for state general fund, you'll see that it's gone down 41% after adjusting for inflation. And in fact, the numbers, the deltas on these two in the far right side, show that most of the tuition increase is accounted for by a loss of state funding per student. And then at the bottom I show, and the costs have gone up. Well, who's funding that? And I believe it was Representative Huffman that asked me about this last time. And non-resident students are now starting to fund that. I'll show you that here in a few minutes.
Thank you.
I was watching Kim Priss do a similar presentation, I believe, to this committee earlier, and she had a chart like this, so I made one just so you could maybe have some comparability. But this is on revenue sources on a per-student basis, and the bottom bar is the state appropriation, the greenish kind of aqua color. The middle part is tuition and fees, and the top is other funds. In our ENG funds, we make interest income, we make indirect cost recoveries on grants and contracts, other unrestricted revenues that come in, and that's been fairly constant at about 10% of the in general budget over time. But you can see the big shift in tuition and state appropriation. This next is just another chart of our revenues from 1996. And why 1996? You may be asking yourself that. And we put a new financial information system in 1996. So it's really easy for me to go back and pull the history from that forward. Prior to that time, as another system is more clunky, I can do it, but it takes a lot more time. So that's why I chose this window. But you can see, you know, our enrollment has also gone up 60%. That's headcount enrollment, the line there with the boxes. And you can just see how the relative mix has changed, and it's largely been filled in with tuition in terms of the growth.
And Jay, before you go on, I mean, 1996 is also when the effects of Measure 5 were beginning to be felt in terms of the state being squeezed, right?
Representative Dumbrough, you're absolutely right. Ballot Measure 5 passed in 1990, but it's a five-year phase-in, and so it started in 1991 and kind of phased in, and we didn't get to kind of the full effect of Ballot Measure 5 until roughly 1996, so you are correct.
For that reason, it would be really nice to have somebody pull the data from before 96 and incorporate them into these slides, because I think that there is a bit of level, stable funding before that, relatively.
Chair Denver, Representative Harker, you're absolutely right. And evident. I do have in another presentation some data prior to that, and it does show that. You know, when I first came into the system in 1983, we used to say that the state paid two-thirds the cost of education and a resident student paid one-third. Unfortunately, today, those numbers are reversed. And, you know, you can also see the same thing in K through 12, because if you look at I teach public finance, and pardon me, and if I lecture to you, tell me to shut up, and I will. But, you know, you can see the same thing in K through 12. Well, you'll see that prior to ballot measure 5, roughly 70% of their budget was funded with property taxes, 30% from the state. Those numbers are reversed today. The state now pays 70%, property taxes 30%. So that was a quantum, and I talked about this last February. I was trying to abbreviate this presentation, but that was a quantum shift in public finance in Oregon when ballot measure 5 passed, and it really changed kind of the landscape at that point.
Do you know where we are compared to the number 46 in 2003?
Where we were in 1996?
Yeah,
is that what you're asking?
Yeah, in the state ranking, we're now 46. Where were we for Measure 5?
Chair Dembrough, I don't know that, but I can look it up and I will get it to you after, if that's okay.
That would be great. Thanks.
Thank you. This next slide, I get a lot of questions about what is the level of state investment in our campuses, what has it been, et cetera. And this slide actually goes back to 91, as you can tell. And what I've done here is I've taken a very simple equation where the numerator is anything that comes from the state. So state general fund for operations, state general fund for debt service, lottery funds for sports action, lottery funds for debt service, opportunity grants that students who have opportunity grants awards bring to the campuses, any research grants that our faculty may do for other state agencies, things like the harvest tax at Oregon State University where we're taxing a board feet of lumber harvest or timber rather harvested out of the forest, etc. And you can see how that's changed. It's dropped markedly at almost every campus. You can also see just the level of dependence on the state at the different institutions, and I think this information is telling and very important.
So presumably, Jay, the reason that U of O is lower in OSU and PSU is because they get more grant funding. So they're getting more money from the federal government, for example, or corporate.
Representative Dembrough, that is in part correct. I mean, as you can see on my footnote at the bottom, the reduced percentage is partially due to growth in other revenue sources. For instance, University of Oregon Lake Department is a very significant business activity. Housing, we're housing more and more students as our populations grow, so we have room and board, revenues and expenses coming into these equations. Grants and contracts, you're absolutely right, at the research universities, Oregon State, Portland State, UVO, that's diluting this number as well. It's also partially related to the types of students that are being served by these institutions. When we adopted the RAM model, is an acronym for Resource Allocation Model, in 1999, we said state funding would follow basically resident students with a couple exceptions. We fund all PhD students, and there's some other minor exceptions. But for instance, University of Oregon serves a lot of non-resident students. They don't get paid for those students by the state. And those students bring, $26,000, $27,000 of tuition with each one of them. And so that dilutes even further, the state investment, if you will. Yes.
Yes, sir. Chair, may I ask a question?
Yes, please.
I want to go back. So that's an interesting aspect of things. But I want to go back to your statement about athletics. I was under the impression that things like, for instance, OSU and U of O football programs, which generate tremendous amounts of income, I was under the impression they don't actually contribute back to the operation of the university. Is that incorrect?
Chairman Dembrough, Representative Gorsuch, these numbers are all funds across everything The university does. Okay, so that denominator is The expenditures of all funds, be they federal, state, local, tuition, athletics, etc. So that's how it's getting in here.
Okay, all right. Thank you.
You're welcome. This is the headcount and the composition of headcount. You can see in every year we have grown in resident students. I want to dispel that rumor. There's been, I think, some people that think we're serving non-residents at the expense of residents. That's not true. You can see the non-resident has probably grown by faster of late and largely out of financial necessity in some sense, and also demand. I think our institutions have a good brand. They fare well in that national market. And the fact that California and Washington, some of our neighboring states, have capped enrollment. I mean, the day those students are told you're in or out of CSU or UC, our phones ring off the hook with people looking for a place they can get an education. And that's been a wonderful amenity, frankly, for our institutions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Any explanation for the big drop in part-time?
Chairman Dembrough, Representative Wisnett, that is largely attributed to the fact that we used to have a lot of institutions that had a part-time fee policy, and it said that if that we didn't actually determine your residency. And we would charge you resident rates if you were part-time. Well, most of our campuses have dropped those policies. They simply can't afford to do that. Yeah. There are still some that do it. That's what the big drop was.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
And Jay, the so we've seen an increase in the non-resident students in part due to the contraction of California's higher education system. Now that they seem to be on track to putting more money into their higher ed system, have there been some projections about what the effect will be on Oregon's non-resident students?
Chairman Dimbrough, there, you know, I was just talking to our institutional research director about this very thing the other day, and while California may be addressing its problems, I still think they will turn students away. And there's a massive amount of international students. We're also getting a lot of folks from China, from the Middle East, from Asia generally. And yeah, I heard a statistic the other day. I'll probably get this wrong, but it's like only 10% of the high school graduates in the world come from America. And, you know, for instance, Oregon State has a contract with a company that routes international students to them. And the pipeline is pretty unlimited. It's amazing. And people are clamoring to get a U.S. education due to the quality and, you know, reputation of our institutions. So we're worried about that. If that happens, it could be, you know, problematic. But, you know, California is also doing the same thing we are now. They are going after non-residents, and they will probably use any of their excess capacity for non-residents out of financial necessity as well. And so you're starting to see that around the country. Every state is relying more and more on non-resident students to pay the bill. And thus, I'm not sure it will change the dynamic in a big market like California, but it could. And, you know, those are the things that, when I don't sleep at night, those are the things I'm thinking about. Because if we get in a situation where our state funding is flat or declining and our enrollment starts to flatten and decline, especially these lucrative non-resident students, we will be in a very difficult position in a very, very quick order.
Mm-hmm. Here, Rep. Johnson.
Jay, quick question. What's the rule of thumb the institutions use for determining the cost for non-resident tuition? Is there a rule of thumb like X percentage on top of what resident is? Just wondering, I don't know. Yeah. It seems like it's roughly at least 2 times, maybe sometimes 3 times the cost.
Chairman Dimbrough, Representative Johnson, it is roughly 3 to 3.5 times the cost, or times the resident tuition rate. You'll see when I start to talk about cost per student, it's a little more than double the cost. I mean, our average tuition is in around $12,505, and I would say at most of our larger institutions, non-resident tuition is north of $25,000 per year. So,
okay, thank you.
So our research is also growing. So, the point I want to leave you with, we're at record levels. We're at record levels in terms of our enrollment. We're at record levels in terms of our research. That's a good thing. We're at record levels in terms of our degrees we're producing. We're doing a lot of things right and well, and that's a good thing. Okay, so I'm going to switch over to institutional cost drivers now. This gets at some of the things I just said. Headcount enrollment up 61% in the last 16 years. FTE up 58%. Student aid's up 200%. CPI has increased 45%. That's measured based on the Portland CPI. Benefit costs. I don't have good data before 2001, so I'm just basing it on 2001 here on benefit costs, 132%. Our employee numbers are up, but as I said, our enrollment, our research, I mean, it takes people to teach people to do those research projects. You know, we're increasingly using part-time faculty. I mentioned that in my last conversation with you. And our facilities costs are up, but we've had to expand our plant. We're trying to accommodate the 40-40-20, and I'll show you more detail on each of these in a minute.
Thank you,
that was my question. You're going to talk more about the benefits. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, so this is our total operating costs. Again, this is all funds. This is grants and contracts, state funds. This is auxiliaries, you know, athletics, all those things blended together. And I did it by kind of major object code because I was mainly looking, where are the deltas? You know, where are the big changes happening? Big changes in OPE, big other payroll expense, that's largely benefits. Big changes in facilities, as I just mentioned, because we're expanding and renovating and taking on more debt. And big changes in assessments, that's largely been abated now. Thank you for the passage of Senate Bill 242 last session.
Assessments to state government?
Most of those assessments do go to state government to pay for things like risk management and things like that, and they were increasing significantly. And that was one of the things you helped us with, actually, with Senate Bill 242, and we're very grateful again for that act. So this is student aid, and this, I think there was
a conversation.
What was
the net transfer number, Mr. Chair?
Excuse me?
Yes.
What was the net transfer number?
The transfer, what does that refer to?
That's transfers out to debt service and things like that, that we're paying bills for debt service, largely.
A big jump from 2006.
Well, actually, could I get back to you on that? I need to delve into the, I don't want to answer the question incorrectly, so I will put that on my list, if I may. So I owe you two things, representing Greenlick, and I will remember them.
Thanks.
I won't. Where do you send me this stuff?
Student aid, big increases here, and we expect to continue to see this. You know, it's one of the things that I think about anyway with 40-40-20 is as we go deeper into high school graduating classes, trying to get a larger proportion of our population educated, we're probably going to go into people, you know, lower income profile peoples, you know, to try to pull them up. They're going to need aid. They're going to need support. Most of this aid, as you can see, is loans coming from the federal government. Big increases there. Federal aid, etc. We do have institutional aid policies. I believe right now each of our campuses remits on average 9% of its tuition for student aid, and that's an average. I actually have some institutions up over 15% and some a little lower than that. So it's just give you an idea, and you can see the state aid in there. That's largely the opportunity grant, etc. So benefit costs compared to the nation. I talked about this briefly last time, but we use AAUP. They do an annual salary survey, the economic status of the profession. These are averages out of their study in 2012. So retirement costs, what do public institutions contribute towards retirement across the country? On average, 10.6% is coming out of the employer side of the equation for retirement. We're at 18%, and depending what happens with PERS, that could go up. Healthcare contributions, on average, are $10,300 paid by the employer. In OUS, is closer to $15,000. I don't want to mislead you here because the healthcare costs are roughly the same throughout the country. It's just who's bearing the costs. In many of our peer institutions, the employee is paying upwards of 40% of the cost. In Oregon, the employee pays 5%. We started that last biennium. And so that's why these are the employer or the university side of those costs.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Not a note about salaries. I mean, how much lower are salaries than the other institutions that are being compared here?
Chairman Dembro, Representative Greenlick, that's a great question. Our salaries, I would say, depending on which institution you're looking at and compared to their peer groups, are in the at the low end, probably 80%, and they probably go up into the low 90s, so in that percentile. Mm-hmm. on salary alone, on total compensation, it's a little different. But
yeah, Jay, do you have a sense of how our total compensation compares around the country? Because that's really the number we need to look at. You know, I mean, there's a decision to put some into salary, some into benefits, but how do our total compensation packages compare?
Well, Chairman Dembro, I sent that information to you after my last conversation, but it's in the, you know, upper 80s to 100%. Total compensation.
Of average.
100%. Of the peers, yes.
Okay, so we're not dramatically more than the peers.
No,
or total
we are not.
Compensation.
No, we're not.
We're less or comparable.
Equal, yeah.
Okay,
thank
you.
That's correct. And you see the private, what private institutions average, just for your edification. So this next slide shows what's happened to benefit costs in since 2001-02. And you can see, and this is on all funds, by the way, including the griefs and grants and auxiliaries, et cetera, but we've gone from $150 million of cost to nearly $350 million cost. And in fact, last year, we paid $41 million more for retirement than we did the year before. And that's sizable. And if we don't reform PERS the way the governor is proposing, we will experience a similar jump next year as well. And that's why I mentioned to you last time, we really support the governor's, or even the co-chairs, you know, I'd take their proposal as well, reform. That other line is how much each of our students is paying for benefit costs. And today, or last year rather, $1,900 a year of their tuition was going solely for benefit costs. Okay. Our employee numbers are up. We actually have more employees today than we've had in the past because we're serving more students, we're doing more research, we're at these record levels. We've had to, and in fact, many of our institutions, you know, there's a lag between the growth and when you can actually hire people. Many of our institutions are hiring today, and they need to restore the quality and to get the coverage that is necessary to make sure we're offering a high-quality degree in the marketplace.
So, and Jay, the headcount, does that include part-time as well as full-time employees? Do you know? Or is this just full-time?
Chairman Dembro, this, I believe, includes part-time, but it does not include students. It includes graduate assistants,
right.
Pardon me. But we employ probably upwards of 20. Let me see, it's about 26,000, including the GAs, and we probably have about 4,000 graduate assistants. So we employ 22,000 students a year. They're not full-time.
Right.
In fact, none of them are, frankly. But that's just unduplicated headcount. That's how many W-2s I issue to student employees. And it's a great way for them to finance their education. It's a great way for them to get some real-world experience in an office-type environment or even a research or lab-type environment. So it's a...
Right. I'm looking at the big numbers at Portland State, the big increase. I suspect a lot of that is part-time teachers.
Chairman Dembro, I would suggest, you know, they have had immense enrollment growth. And, yeah, that's probably part-time and probably even some full-time people. You know, they've hired a number of new counselors to try to improve their retention rates and graduation rates. I think President Vivell has talked to you about that. And, you know, we are hiring people. And, you know, we are growing. We are strong. And I think that's a good thing. We're making progress. Mm-hmm. To your 40-40-20 goals. Types of faculty is a driver of cost and quality. I talked about this a little bit last time. Part-time faculty, we use more and more of them. They're less expensive. and I think you know the pros and cons of that. They probably have higher teaching loads. They're more specialized, if you will. our full-time tenure-track faculty do instruction, research, service, and what I call kind of administration, helping to maintain the curriculum, serving on committees, you know, to run the campus, et cetera. Whereas part-time and fixed-term employees have a more focused role, if you will. You know, and all of our institutions are struggling to maintain what I would call an appropriate mix of faculty. And we probably have too few full-time and too many part-time in most cases.
Chair?
Yes.
I had a question about types of faculty. It seems to me, as I recall, at our university, the business faculty got higher salaries. And if we're looking at programs like STEM and really needing to hire faculty who teach in the tech kinds of areas, would they also be getting higher salaries than, say, an English professor or something?
Chairman Dembrough, representing Gallegos, you're right. Not across the board, though. Some of our smaller campuses, like Western, for instance, has a contract and they hire people in a step system, irrespective of the curriculum they're teaching. The larger research institutions, there is both a difference in salary and a difference in workload expectations by discipline. And generally, business have one of the highest starting salaries because those folks could go to work in the private sector. Generally, engineering and science probably have a higher cost just because of the demand in the private sector. And so you're absolutely right. STEM in particular costs more, but it's very important to our economy. And so, you know, that's kind of the price, if you will. This is just a chart that shows full-time versus part-time faculty, and as I mentioned, you know, both are growing, but the top bar there is growing at a faster rate than the bottom bar. This is our, you know, one of the metrics our board uses to measure quality is students per full-time faculty, you know, and most of our peers are around 20. And you can see we had an initiative back in the mid-2000s to try to drive that down. We made some progress, but frankly, we've lost ground with both the enrollment growth and the budgetary, you know, challenges that we've faced. Facilities costs. I mentioned our physical plants are growing. They're expanding. They're being renovated. The good news, the bottom line there is utilities. The good news is on a cost per square foot, our costs are actually going down. We put in a lot of efficiency measures, you know, using different types of energy and other things to actually drive those costs down, you know, re-insulating, changing the ballasts and lights, renovating, you know, trying to lower costs. So our costs per square foot are down, but our square footage at every campus has gone up. And, you know, to serve more students, you've got to have, and to do more research, you've got to have the space. And, you know, it's interesting if you think about higher ed growth in the 60s with the passage of the GI Bill and the Johnson, you know, the New Deal, if you will, we had large growth. And we still have a lot of buildings that were built during that time, and they're now hitting, you know, times where they need to be renovated, they need to be, in some cases, replaced or expanded. You know, pedagogies have changed, student tastes have changed, et cetera, and that drives these factors. I'm sorry.
Thank you. Representative.
Real quick, thank you, Mr. Chair. The increase in debt service really looks like it's going up. I'm sure you're looking at refinancing. I know we do in the local, our community college, with the new rates. So that's a really significant, with lower rates that we have now, that your debt service looks like it's really increasing.
Yeah, Chairman Dembrough, Representative Whitney, you're absolutely right. We just refinanced. In fact, I think the Treasurer did a press release on this, a big bond issuance. I think we refunded $300 million of bonds and saved, I want to say the net present value is around $40 million of debt service. And we have been doing that right along. In fact, State Treasurer has algorithms they're running every month against our debt portfolio, looking if they can obtain attain certain levels of savings, they automatically will trigger a refunding. So they've been very helpful. But, and you'll see this across the board at every public, you know, and it's, you know, I tell my students this all the time, why has the use of debt gone up recently? Well, because the cost is really cheap right now. I mean, it's a good time to borrow. And across the board, it doesn't matter what industry you're in, people are borrowing more because the costs are cheap. And we're also experiencing a big enrollment growth, a big research growth, et cetera, that, you know, we need the space to do our work.
But at the same time, Jay, the, you know, I would say that the university and college construction has helped to keep the struggling construction industry afloat during these hard times. Do you have any data of just how many jobs, how many construction jobs have been created by the construction work that the universities have done?
Chairman Dembrough, we do have that data. We commonly use that there are 9 jobs created for every $1 million spent. And I can provide you a historical summary of that. We also have run economic multiplier effects of those jobs, that it actually churns through the economy 2 and 3 times, because we pay those construction workers, they buy groceries, they buy things in the marketplace, thereby employing other people who then, you know, those monies echo through the economy, if you will. So that was very important. And in fact, during the first part of the recession, we got very gracious capital budgets from this body that allowed us to keep a lot of people employed and to keep a lot of work going and a lot of and the economy from slipping further into the recession.
Thank you, Jay. Yes, Representative.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Vice Chancellor, has any of your debt been used to pay PERS obligation?
Chairman Dembrough, Representative Wisnett, the state as a whole, sold $2 billion in pension obligation bonds, I believe in 02 or 03. And we participate in the repayment of that. It's an assessment. It's part of our other payroll expense rates. It's about 6% per employee, or 6% per dollar of payroll we pay that goes. We transfer the money to DAS. DAS then amalgamates it from all agencies and pays the debt service on those pension obligation bonds.
Thank you.
Yes.
Administrative costs have grown. This was a direct question I got last time. What's happened with administrative costs? They have gone up, as you can see. Remember, CPI is about 46%, so maybe they've gone up at twice the rate of CPI. But take into account the growth that we've had, the growth in research. It takes administrators to administer that. We have a lot of federal requirements, human subjects, lab animals, other things that we have to attend to in research projects, making sure we're not being cruel and inhumane to either one of those populations, be they animals or people. And we are running effectively small cities. I mean, if you think about a university of 25,000 to 30,000, or even the smaller campuses at 4,000 to 8,000 students, they are the effect of a small city, and they require people to do that. Some of the growth, like PSU, for instance, I'm more familiar with. I used to be the vice president of finance at that institution. We went a long way. We grew from 15,000 to 25,000 students in 5 years, and our administration didn't grow concomitantly with that. And then they caught up later because they realized they didn't have enough administrators to run the place. Some of these numbers actually trouble me at OIT, at Southern, spending less today, and these are unadjusted for inflation dollars, than we spent in 1996 worries me. Do we have good internal controls at those institutions? Do we have enough people to actually run the place? And so, you know, I don't think these are out of line. In fact, in some cases, I worry they're too low. But it is always a concern of, you know, folks, what's happening with administrative costs.
Do you have a sense, Jay, of how the, and I know we have a bill that we're considering that would start tracking these numbers more closely, but how, you know, for example, at the U of O, the number, that 166% increase compares to the increase in the number of full-time faculty over that period, or Portland State?
Chairman Dimbro, I can get you that. I don't have it on the top of my head. I'm sorry, my file cabinets are spilling over as is, but no, I will resurrect it and send it to you if that's okay.
Thank you.
So what's happened to the average cost of instruction? By the way, this cuts across all types of students, be they graduate or undergraduate, be they resident or non-resident. We look at, you know, we take our instructional costs, 100% of those. We take 100% of our academic support, like dean's offices, libraries, things like that. We prorate, you know, administrative costs based on how much time we spend in instruction versus research and service. And we come up with an average cost per student. These, again, are unadjusted for inflation, but you can see, you know, our costs up until last year were running pretty close to CPI. And I think that's a tribute to our productive people. Our faculty are doing more. Our staff are doing more. And the tick up in 2012 was largely that $41 million purse cost. I mean, it just bumped it. We couldn't absorb, we couldn't be efficient fast enough to absorb those cost increases. So that's why it kind of ticked up in the last year.
Okay, Jay, hold on. Yep. Vice Chair Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jay, do you have a complete breakdown per student of where those costs are allocated? You mentioned the $1,900 mm-hmm. per student for PERS. Do you carry that on out and have something you could send to us that accommodates the full 100%?
Chairman Dimbro, Representative Huffman, I can try. You know, what's happened, there's two factors that are working and in some sense compound one another. One is the costs are going up, the other is the state funding is going down, and so when I show you that, that'll show you that compounding or compounding factor, if you will. But I think I can do that. I have to modify, you know, I have to take the costs back to E&G and then I have to split it by revenue source. Do you want to know by revenue source, or you just want to know by cost component?
Probably cost component, because you had told us the other day, kind of where the revenue streams came from per student. So
I think I can do that. My people who are watching me are probably cringing, but we
we're here to help.
Yeah. No, we can probably do that.
Great. And we're probably going to have to wrap up. So
okay. Just really quick, I have just a couple more slides. This is average cost of education per student by institution. OIT has the highest cost, and this gets back to your comment, Representative Gallego. They do healthcare and they do engineering, and so it's high cost. Some of the others, you can just see where they're at and what the trend has been. This gets to the question that Representative Huffman asked me last time I talked. You know, who's paying for this? Well, you can see in 1991, 72% of the cost was paid by the general fund of the state and 25% by resident tuition and just a really small piece by non-resident. Those numbers started to shift in 01, and then in 2012, you can now see that 50% is roughly paid by tuition, or 57 rather, by tuition, 27 by general fund, and 15% by non-resident students. That's that piece. If we didn't have those non-resident revenues, we wouldn't be able to balance our budget. And that concludes my presentation right on time. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Professor, that was very informative. Yes, Rick
Johnson. Appreciate the report too, and I have a lot of questions, but would it be possible maybe to bring Jay back for just, let's say, a half an hour, just Q&A time at some point in the near future, because I'm sure there are other questions that his report's generated, and if that's possible. I know he has a lot on his plate, but I think it'd be helpful, especially as you move towards into some of our governance ideas and so forth too. Some of the topics we're going to be talking about, i.e. shared services and the benefit, that kind of thing. I think if that's possible, it might really be helpful for our work.
Yes, let's talk about it. We'll try to get Jay back as soon as we can.
I'm at your service.
Thank you, Jay. Yes, Rep. Parker, then we're going to have to ask.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. A very quick question, just to see if I've connected some dots here.
On slide four, you have percent the dollar change of resident tuition adjusted $2,012 for inflation. Change is $2,380. On slide 14, that's the one where we talk about the change, the amount of money going for benefits, which was $1,900. Correct?
That's on average per student.
Things are hidden in the averages.
Yeah.
But on average. Over on the left-hand side, you start out at 2001, 2002. There is a bullet point on 2002, 2003, which is the same year that the tuition data delta was calculated from. I'm eyeballing that. It's not 640 as it was the biennium before. Let's say it's 720. That means leaves $1,180 change from 2002 to 2003 to current for benefits. That is, by my calculation, 50% of the increase in tuition. What's wrong with what I've just said?
Boy, Representative Chairman Denver, Representative Harker, I'd be happy to come to your office. I've, you know, you said it so fast, and I was in wind-down mode.
Okay, understood. I will send the question with the references and the numbers.
I'm happy to come to you and talk to you about it. You're probably right, but I'd have to unwind that and think about it.
Right, yes, once we get that information, we'll share it with everyone. Thank you very much, Jay. I'm going to close the informational hearing on the cost drivers. And, yes, Rick.
I have a quick correction.
Yeah.
We have a lot of differences of opinion, but I think we all care about each other. And I'm concerned for Representative Gallegos' safety due to what he said on record about his wife's credit card. I just want to go on record as saying I heard him say he's very proud of his wife's participation in the American free market system.
He's a believer in the American dream.
Yes, Mr. Martinez would appreciate that.
Yes. colleagues, just before we adjourn, so Friday we're going to be having another governance day. We're going to be focusing on the issues of the bonding, the composition of the boards, and tuition. We'll be taking public testimony on those issues. Victoria yesterday sent you a whole packet of material that was submitted to us during the special joint committee, rather than have all the dog and pony shows again and again. I'd ask you, if you find some free time, to look at those, see what questions you have, and we'll, you know, get those questions answered for you. Okay, with that, colleagues, we are adjourned.